Murfreesboro.
This is FM 100.5, 101.9, AM 1450, and WGNSradio.com. Rutherford County's place to talk. Stand by, Rutherford County. The WGNS Action Line continues a search for truth.
Program. I am Assistant District Attorney General J. Paul Newman. My co-host is District Attorney General William C. Weitzel, Jr. This is our third program overall and our first one of the new year. We want to wish everyone a very happy new year and hope that all of you have a safe and happy 2014. I've had many people ask when the program will be on next, and I appreciate the listener interest. This program airs the first Friday of every month from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. We appreciate WGNS airing the program and providing this service to the community. If you have any suggestions or comments concerning the program, please feel free to email me at jpaul1949newman@yahoo.com. Now to tell you about today's program. During today's program, you will hear about a past criminal trial. The location of the crime was in Smyrna, Tennessee, and involved the armed robbery and triple murder at the Captain D's restaurant in July of 2000. During the robbery, three employees of Captain D's lost their lives. It is a very tragic story and one that still affects this community. Joining us for that discussion will be Detective Rick Hall, of the Smyrna Police Department. Detective Hall is one of the primary investigators who was responsible for solving the Captain D's case. He will tell you about many interesting aspects of the investigation and how citizens of the community came forward and were such an important part in successfully bringing justice to the three families who had lost a loved one. On today's show, we're also privileged to have Robin Gentry from the Rutherford County Clerk's Office. Miss Robin will give us information on what you should expect in court if you are ever the victim of a crime, a witness, or a defendant. Miss Robin will also tell us about upcoming trials scheduled to start early this year. Also during the program, General Weitzel will discuss a specific area of the law. And in the final segment of the program, we will ask all of the listeners to help solve a mystery. Law enforcement will be asking for your help in determining who killed 2-year-old Annalise Guerrero. Annalise Guerrero was last seen alive at her home in Smyrna on April 23, 2006. She disappeared that night, and no one has reported seeing her alive since. Her remains were found in an area of the Stones River battlefield in 2008. We welcome you to the program and thank you for listening, and we ask your help in seeking justice. We will begin the program after you listen to these important messages.
The time is now. Bob Bud's Auction. The time is now.
A total of 5 West Main Street properties here in Murfreesboro will be auctioned off as a whole, selling subject to court approval. This auction is going to be on Saturday, January 11th at 10 a.m. Again, in Murfreesboro at 1204 West Main Street. See pictures online at BobParksAuction.com.
Here's Dr. Craig McCabe at McCabe Vision Center.
Macular degeneration is the most common cause of vision loss for people over 50 years of age.
Dr. Craig McCabe, the eye doctor you hear on the radio.
And they found things to slow down the macular degeneration. For example, you should be on high doses of certain vitamins and antioxidants.
McCabe Vision Center on Heritage Park Drive, just off Memorial, behind SunTrust Bank.
Where is the best barbecue in town? At 1920 East Main. The best barbecue for miles around is at 1920 East Main. You can buy it by the pound, sandwich, platter, or plate. No matter what you choose, it will taste great. You can come with a friend, by yourself, or with a date. to Slick Pig Barbecue. Barbecue pork, beef, or chicken, Brunswick stew, down home atmosphere, and they cater. Slick Pig Barbecue, it's the best.
Your call to Mid-South Bank is very important to us. Our commitment to personal service is unequaled. Just as a real person instead of a recording answered your phone call, an experienced member of our staff will handle your business. Every customer is important. We are your local bank with our corporate headquarters right here in Rutherford County. We know that local contacts for your entire customer service issues means a great deal. That's why we like to say we're the oldest, newest bank in Rutherford County. Stop by and let us make a difference in your financial success.
He's Rutherford County's consumer warrior.
This is the real deal.
Clark Howard, weekdays 11 to 1 on WGNS, AM, FM, online. From call to conviction, time now for a look back at one of the more intriguing and important cases for this community. From the crime, the investigation, to the prosecution.
Sometime between 11:50 p.m. July the 11th, 2000, and 2:20 a.m. July the 12th, 2000, tragedy struck the town of Smyrna, Tennessee. There was an armed robbery at the Captain D's restaurant located at 402 North Lowry Street. As a result of that robbery, three Captain D's employees lost their lives. Shot to death was Scott Myers, Brian Spite, and Troy Snail. Scott Myers was a manager trainee working his last scheduled shift at the Smyrna restaurant. Scott Myers was 42 years old, married, and the father of three young daughters. Brian Spite was an assistant manager and was in the process of closing the restaurant when he lost his life. Brian Spite was 29 years old, lived in Nashville, and had one daughter. Troy Snell was a 17-year-old cashier working at Captain D's and was a senior at Laverne High School. Troy lived at home with his parents. Other than the three victims who were killed that night, the last person or employee to leave the restaurant clocked out at 11:50 p.m., July the 11th, 2000. Less than a couple of hours later, the first person that discovered that something was wrong was a dumpster truck driver. The driver had emptied the dumpster behind Captain D's and had then proceeded to the rear of the nearby Kmart to empty that dumpster. While behind Kmart, the driver noticed a car in the area, and the lights on the car were very dim. He approached the car and saw a young man inside of the car in the driver's seat. He thought at that time that the young man was asleep and made noise to wake him up. When he saw no response, he called the police. The call was placed at 2:20 a.m., July the 12th, 2000. The police responded and discovered that the young man was Troy Snell. Troy had been shot to death. About 3 a.m., the person who regularly treated the Captain D's restaurant for pest control arrived for his regularly scheduled treatment. He entered the restaurant and noticed that the alarm was not set, and he began performing his duties. When he opened the cooler, he saw a body. He promptly called the police at 3:46 a.m., July the 12th, 2000. When the police arrive, they find that Brian Spite and Scott Myers have also been shot to death. Captain D's management is notified and is determined that a large amount of money was missing from the restaurant. Detective Rick Hall was one of the primary investigators on the Captain D's case, and with the assistance of other law enforcement officers, the Captain D's case was investigated and solved. Charged with the robbery and murders of Scott Myers, Brian Spite, and Troy Snell were LaTanya Taylor, who was arrested on July the 19th, 2001, and Percy Palmer, who was arrested in Aurora, Colorado, on August 2nd, 2001. LaTanya Taylor decided to have a trial. Her trial was heard before the Honorable Judge Don R. Ash. The trial began on September 20th, 2004, and ended on September 28th, 2004, when LaTanya Taylor was found guilty as charged. She is now serving three life sentences without the possibility of parole. She will never be released from prison. After the Taylor trial, Percy Palmer waived his right to a trial and entered a plea of guilty before Judge Don Ash. Palmer pled to all three murders and is presently serving three life sentences in the Tennessee Department of Corrections. Palmer will not be eligible for parole until the year 2059. It is my honor to have with us today Detective Rick Hall of the Smyrna Police Department. Detective Hall, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you.
Detective Hall, we have you here today, and we'd like for you to tell us just basically how you became involved in the investigation and some of the interesting aspects. Can you tell us, for instance, how many people responded to that particular crime scene?
Of course, that night we had third shift on, and then we immediately called day shift on. All the detectives we had in our office at that time, which was about six of us, all come out. We made a call in the TBI and General Weitzel that morning. TBI asked if we wanted to send out an agent, and they, at that time we said yes, and we had over 25 agents then show up from the TBI along with our detectives and officers that we had out there for that day.
Now, as far as the investigation, how did the investigation proceed? Was it one where there were quickly suspects, or was there one that required a large amount of investigation and interviewing before suspects were developed?
That time everybody was. We were getting, we teamed up agents, Smyrna officer and a TBI agent, and we're running leads. And we went for almost 3 days straight of doing nothing but checking leads and hitting our housing projects. And at the end of the day, we ended up with over 1,500 leads. So the first 300 or 400 happened in those first few days of us having this case happen.
Now, as you know, this program is designed to elicit people to help in solving cold cases and cases of significance in this jurisdiction. How significant was the help of community members and citizens in helping resolve this situation?
It's huge. Law enforcement, we have to rely on our citizens to give us information and tell us things. We can use all the CSI and things like that to get us there, but it still takes citizen involvement to get us the rest of the way that we need. It takes that one lead, that one phone call, that one tip that gets us in the right direction where it puts all the pieces of the puzzle together.
Now, can you tell us, I know that it took a long time for the investigation, and from a reading of the summary of the case, it appears that it lasted many years. During the pendency from the time that this crime happened until the time that you were not working on it actively anymore, how much time was that? How much time did you devote to this case?
Well, I was from 2000 to 2004, of course, the end of the LaTonya Taylor trial. The first 3 years, I did nothing but this case. I took on other cases for that last year, but coming up to the trial, we traveled to Chattanooga to pick the jury for this, and I spent many days then and weeks before the trial at the DA's office trying to get our witnesses together and tracking down holes that we felt were in it. We would call on people at the DA's office to where y'all were doing interviews with them, and there was many nights we spent in the evenings. I can remember being at the DA's office and strategizing who we were going to call first and what our order was, and it was a ton of work.
I know that ultimately your investigation led you to the suspects that were involved in this case, and there was some surveillance that was conducted. And General Weitzel, I will ask you if you can kind of summarize what the surveillance was about.
Well, Paul, if I recall correctly, we had an individual or a couple of individuals that knew Miss Taylor. And at that time, she was staying in a motel, and these individuals were staying there. The police department arranged to set up where we could listen and record the conversations, and actually they did that. And those individuals were able to get Ms. Taylor to talk about the crime and her involvement in it. And that was very significant in solving the case, of course. And one thing I wanted to point to, that Detective Hall mentioned, you think, or a lot of people may think, when an arrest is made, that the investigation ends. But in this case, actually, up until a week before the trial, we had another witness that came forward that proved to be very important. And Detective Hall, I'm sure, recalls that, and he interviewed that witness, and she was pivotal in the case also.
Okay. Detective Hall, I know that this was a case that had some very important aspects to it, and one of the aspects that I think was important was the use of the media and the TV networks in trying to develop leads. Can you tell us about what you did in that regard?
We always try to keep, of course, this was a major thing. It hit on the heels of, if you remember, Dennis Paul Reed was doing the murders in Nashville and Clarksville, and this hit on the heels of that. And we weren't used to having stuff like that in Smyrna. You know, I grew up, I'm a lifelong guy of Smyrna, and we weren't used to things like that. So it was, we tried to always keep it in the media. We raised, you know, over $60,000 for the ward fund. I would spend every Friday morning, Scott Myers' wife, Julie, would call me, and it was every Friday morning phone call that I would field from her, and I had to talk to her every Friday, and she'd want to know, you know, what we've done for the past week and checking in with her. And this got several months down the road, and leads would dwindle and things were falling out, and she curbed her view. She wanted to help. So this case went on America's Most Wanted, and America's Most Wanted go after fugitives. They know who they are, and we know who we're looking for, and they'll show a picture of him, and if you've seen Mr. John Doe, please give us a call. This was the first show that America's Most Wanted did. It was a whodunit, and they gave a whole hour-long show of whodunit cases from all over the United States, and ours being one of them. And it was directly related to, you know, Scott Myers' widow, Julie, going to work and going to bat, and that made us to where we had to come strategize with y'all and come up with things that we could give them, or hooks, that things we've not released to the media. It was really hard to keep this case quiet. There's a lot of rumors and things going around and trying to discredit those. And, you know, you get investigative reporters with the media that go out on whims and want to, you know, the get revenue and viewers, that they would come up with these things. So it was really tough. But at the end of the day, we had to keep that media on our side.
It's obvious that Scott Myers' widow was very important in this case. What about the other two victims' families, the Spite family and the Troy Snell family? How involved were they, and how big a part did they play in this investigation?
Troy's mom and dad, I talked to them regularly as well. There would be days that Mr. Snell would be upset and having a bad day, and he would call, and I was his vent person. There was days that, you know, they lived right down in Laverne, and I'd get in the car and have to go down and sit with them. And, you know, I was partnered the whole time with TBI agent Rick Stout, and you know, Rick and I got very close, and, you know, everybody called us Rick Squared, because you never saw one without the other. And Nikita was Brian Spate's girlfriend, so it was all the time I was fielding phone calls from her and what was going on. And he had a grandmother. He was actually originally from Washington, D.C. area, so that every once in a while I'd get the grandmother having a bad day, and she would call.
Can you tell me, how would you describe the cooperation that was provided to you by the Captain D's personnel and management?
From the get-go, it was awesome. The Shoney's store that was next door, you know, they basically closed down the whole rear of their area, and that was our command post. These days of having trailers and things that we have access to today, we didn't have back then. And they opened the whole back end of the restaurant, which was part of that. The parent company of Captain D's was a Shoney Corporation, but, you know, they put up a lot of the money in the beginning. When we had the trial, they, you know, they flew our family in and things like that, as far as getting them in here and providing them with somewhere to stay. And they really went to bat for the victims, you know, the families.
General Weitzel, you were, of course, in charge of this case. And can you tell us what punishment you sought concerning the Captain D's murder, and how the trial went, and what was the outcome as far as this case?
Well, Paul, I know you'll remember, and Tom Jackson worked on this case, probably put in more hours than I did. I know that. But we sought the death penalty because of the fact that there were three homicides and involved a robbery. That was one of the reasons, because of the publicity. We went to Chattanooga. Mr. Jackson and I went down, and we spent a week in Chattanooga selecting the jury, and the jury had to be death qualified. That is, they had to say that they would consider the death penalty in this case. And of course, the case against Ms. Taylor was tried, and my recollection is that it was 10-2 in favor of the death penalty, but of course that requires a unanimous verdict, and if the jury cannot reach a verdict, then it's an automatic life without parole sentence. So, but it was probably one of the most trying cases that I've handled. I'm sure you would say the same thing. I know that Tom, it almost drove him crazy. I know he worried Detective Hall, he worried me, but certainly without his commitment and the number of hours, I'm talking about after hours, that he worked on the case, I don't believe we'd been successful.
One of the significant things that I felt during the trial was that during the proof, we were unable to establish who actually did the shooting of these victims or whether both of them did shootings. How significant do you think that was in the punishment aspect of that trial?
Well, I think that I think had we been able to say that in Ms. Taylor's trial that she was the one that actually fired the shots, I believe it would have been a death penalty verdict. But because we were not able to say between the two who actually pulled the trigger, that was a problem for us in seeking the death penalty. But certainly it's one of the most heinous crimes that we've witnessed in this community. And I know, as Detective Hall pointed out, we did a lot of things in this case to solve it that we don't normally do. I remember going to outside of Washington, D.C., to Quantico, Virginia, to seek the help of the FBI in their criminal profiling unit. And as he mentioned, the America's Most Wanted show. So a lot of hours went into the investigation and solving and successful prosecution of the case.
Well, Detective Hall, we want to congratulate you on the solving of this case. We want to thank you for coming to the radio station today and being a party to this program. And we wish you great luck in the future.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Hello, this is Peter Demas with Demas's Restaurant, a family restaurant tradition for four generations, now in our 24th year, serving our most popular menu item, great-tasting oven-baked chicken soup. Back in 1989, when my mom and dad were planning Demas's, they debated whether baked chicken soup should even be on the menu. Both agreed that it was a good item, but they weren't sure it would be accepted. Because my dad and his sisters had eaten it all of their lives, especially when anybody had a bad cold, they decided to risk it. They did it, and now I can say the rest is history. We made over 65,000 gallons last year and make more every day. We sell it by the cup, bowl, quart, or gallon. You can even freeze it for shipping or to save it for a later date. Give yourself a treat today. Baked chicken soup, buy it in the store or get it to go. Demas's Restaurant in Murfreesboro, Lebanon, downtown Nashville, and Hendersonville. Get your chicken soup today.
Bell Jewelers on Broad Street, across from Toots.
I'm Greg Tidwell.
And I'm Lisa Halliburton. Bell Jewelers welcomes you.
What you can expect at Bell Jewelers: free estimates on all clock, watch, pocket watch, and jewelry repair. Free jewelry cleaning and prong check while you wait.
Bell Jewelers, the current leader in jewelry trends and in-house jewelry and watch repair.
Bell Jewelers on Broad Street, across from Toots.
Bell Jewelers, family owned and operated since 1879.
I want everybody to understand that music lessons aren't just for kids. You can do lessons at any age. And on our drum lesson program, we now have Mr. David Northrup teaching in the store, one of the top pro drummers in the country, who's toured with Travis Tritt, John Mellencamp, Lee Greenwood, and lately with Winona Judd. Dave's a great pro drummer, and he's teaching here at Music World and Drummer's Den, 2762 South Church, across from Indian Hills Golf Course.
At the Salvation Army Family Store, you can get bargain prices on clothes, furniture, household goods, electronics, and more. Every Wednesday, get 50% off most items in the store.
All the clothes that we have in the store, no matter what color tag it is half off.
Store manager Mark Sheridan.
Usually, we do run some other type of sale on the furniture and other things that we do sell here in the family store.
Your purchases go directly to fund Salvation Army programs here in Rutherford County. The Salvation Army Family Store is at 125 South Front Street, across from Captain D's on Broad.
This is Inside the Courts, a look at this month's trials, pleas, and grand jury action. Inside the Courts is presented as a courtesy of the Rutherford County Clerk's Office.
We want to welcome to the program this morning Ms. Laura Bowling, who is the Rutherford County Circuit Court Clerk. We're glad to have you here, Ms. Bowling.
Good morning.
And also the Chief Deputy Clerk in the Criminal Division, Ms. Robin Gentry. And, Robin, as you know, the grand jury does not meet until Monday, so we don't have a grand jury report today. But let's take this opportunity to discuss the court system and what citizens need to know if they are either a defendant, the victim of a crime, or maybe even a witness in a criminal case. Tell us, once a warrant has been issued and served on a defendant, how is the first court appearance set, the date picked in the General Sessions Court?
Well, first of all, good morning and Happy New Year to everyone. Court dates are preset usually by the arresting officer for their day in court. If the Sheriff's Department happens to serve the warrant, then they will set the court date when they serve it.
And when the case comes to court on that first court appearance, tell us, what should a defendant or the victim of a crime, if they're there, or even a witness, what should they expect to happen on the first appearance?
Well, first of all, the judge is going to call the docket for the defendant, and if there's a victim, they will call for them as well. And then the judge will ask the defendants if they would like a continuance or would they like to discuss their case with the district attorney to see what they have offered them, what they will offer them, and they'll tell them where to go to speak with them. And then if the defendant doesn't like the offer, then the judge will ask them if they want to apply for a public defender or if they want time to retain counsel.
And typically, when we speak of talking to the defendants in general sessions, we're talking about misdemeanor cases.
Exactly.
Because the general sessions judge does not have the jurisdiction over felony cases other than to send those to the grand jury.
That's right.
If the case is settled in general sessions court and there is a fine and the court cost, how is the defendant allowed to pay the fine and cost?
Well, they have two options. One is to pay in full the day of court, or to pay through the Providence Probation Office.
Okay. So if a defendant does not have the sufficient funds to pay in the entirety the cost and the fine, the probation office will set up a payment plan for them.
That's right.
And send the money to the clerk's office.
That's right.
And if there's restitution that's owed to the victim of a crime, how is that collected?
Well, in general sessions court and in circuit court misdemeanor cases, the restitution is collected and distributed by Providence Probation. If it's a felony conviction, and of course felony convictions are going to be in the criminal circuit court, then it is paid through the court clerk's office and we distribute it to the victims.
And speaking of the criminal court, if a case is bound over to the grand jury and indicted, then the case goes to the criminal court. And tell us what happens.
Well, first of all, there's an arraignment process. That's usually the third Monday of each month for the grand jury that meets the first week of each month. And at arraignment, there's a call of the docket. The defendants come up. They are given a copy of the indictment. The judge asks them if they understand what they're charged with, if they would like for them to read it, or if they can read it on the record, or if they can read it for themselves. They ask them if they have an attorney or would they like to apply for a public defender.
And after the arraignment, what is the next step in the process?
Well, there's the discussion or the status docket.
And at that particular docket, usually the state furnishes the defendant's counsel what we call discovery, in other words, the evidence that the state has against the defendant and makes an offer of settlement. And what is the next court appearance that the defendant makes?
Well, that will be the plea day. And at that time, they will either accept the offer that the state has given them or maybe put it off to think about it or set it for trial.
Okay. Now, we've talked about what seems like a fairly simple process.
Yes, sir.
Can you tell us, are there any delays that occur usually in criminal cases?
Yes, sir. And it's not unusual. A lot of times, maybe some of the discovery hasn't been provided. The defense may want time to go over additional discovery, or their client may wish to think about what the state has offered them.
And certainly in the more complex cases, such as the one we discussed here earlier, the
right.
Captain D's case, those cases have many, many pretrial motions and numerous settings to handle pretrial things that the court has to hear.
Yes, typically in cases like that, you can expect from the time it goes to grand jury, it's not going to go to trial for at least a year.
Yes. Now, speaking of trials, we want to begin our next segment by noting that the defendants that may be named in these trials have not been convicted, and they are presumed to be innocent until convicted in our system. But tell us about any noteworthy trials that are coming up in the near future.
Well, we get a little bit of a reprieve in January. We don't have anything that big, but in February, we have, beginning February the 10th, the Aaron Walker and John Lamondola trial that's scheduled for Judge Bragg's courtroom. In March 24th, we have the trial of Jacob Perriman. He's charged with first-degree murder of his wife and the aggravated assault of her 7-year-old son. It will be in Judge Bragg's courtroom. April the 8th, we have the trial of Moses Bess. He's charged with the first-degree murder of his wife in 1986. This will be in Judge Bragg's courtroom. May the 5th, we have the trial of Brandon Buchanan. He's charged with the murder of Bruce Thomas. This trial will be in Judge Siskin's courtroom.
All right. Well, Robin, we want to thank you for being a part of the program today, and also thank Ms. Bowling for being here and allowing you to be here kind of give the listeners an update on what's taking place in their court system here in Rutherford County.
Thank you.
That update brought to you by Quaker State. Stop in at your local Walmart and pick up a 5-quart jug of conventional Quaker State motor oil today for only $14.47. Real durable oil. See QuakerState.com for details.
Hello, my name is Gary McGuire. I'm the proprietor of Opossum's Pub. Come in and try us out.
Okay, the atmosphere here is great. It's family-owned, and you really feel like part of the family.
Pulled chicken is excellent, very, very fresh. The fish and chips are incredible, the best around.
Oh, the food's awesome.
My name is Gary McGuire, and I approve this message.
Stop by Opossum's, located on Memorial Boulevard, opposite Sportscom in the Kroger Shopping Center.
Play it again, sports!
Your fitness headquarters.
This is Scott inviting you to come in and check out the largest selection of new and used fitness equipment in Murfreesboro. New equipment arriving daily.
Trade in, trade up.
Play it again, sports!
On Thompson Lane.
WGNS Time Saver Traffic.
Good morning. We've got clear conditions at this point in Murfreesboro, but very cold. Make sure you have a couple minutes on the front end of your commute to scrape that windshield if your car's been left out overnight. And, of course, we've got some possible icy spots out there from the very bitter cold this morning and also the moisture that came with the front that came through yesterday. So anticipate some possible slippery spots. Out with the old and in with the new with a liquid lift from Dr. Beautiful. 2 syringes of Juvederm and 40 units of Botox for just $1,299. Call 931-433-6871 or visit drbeautiful.net. Randy Bryan with traffic on WGNS.
Stay ahead of severe weather. Get breaking news and local sports scores first. This is Jenny Williams at Gill's Ace Hardware in Smyrna. We sponsor text alerts from WGNSradio.com. Look for the sign-up link on the homepage. It's a free service.
Now more than ever, count on WGNS. Locally owned, locally operated, and responding to your local opinions. Issues that impact the heart of Tennessee. WeatherEye.
We'll see sunny skies continuing this afternoon with high temperatures in the lower 30s, and expect clear conditions tonight with a chilly low temperature down to 19. I'm WGNS meteorologist Sam Donaisky.
Right now it's 18 degrees.
We're WGNS, FM 100.5, FM 101.9, and AM 1450. Worldwide at WGNSradio.com. What's the law? Time now for an examination of the laws of Tennessee. This is not intended to be legal advice and is being presented solely for the informational benefit of our listening audience. You should always consult with an attorney whenever you need or rely on legal advice.
Paul, at this time, I want to talk a little bit about the law. And one of the things that I think has been in the news here recently is that the state of Colorado has legalized the recreational use of marijuana, and Washington State will soon follow that sometime in the spring. I've heard that characterized as an experiment to see how that works out. And so I thought I would talk about the law in the state of Tennessee in regards to marijuana and some of the conceptions or misconceptions. The first thing I want to mention is a lot of people don't understand that in order to have a felony on any drug offense, marijuana included, that an individual must possess that drug either with the intent to sell it or distribute it, or they must actually engage in the sale or distribution or the manufacture of the drug. Simply having the drug in your possession for your own use is a misdemeanor. In regards to marijuana, if you possess less than 10 pounds with the intent to sell it or distribute it, that is a Class E felony, which is the lowest grade felony. It carries a sentence of 1 to 2 years and a fine not more than $5,000. Now, if you have 10 to 70 pounds of marijuana with the intent to sell or deliver it, then that goes up to a Class D felony that carries a sentence of up to 4 years and a fine of up to $50,000. And then there's some punishment for what we call mega amounts. Amounts of marijuana where you have 20 to 99 plants that you're manufacturing, or maybe you possess over 70 pounds of marijuana up to 300 pounds. Now, we don't have many of those cases. And the one reason I also wanted to touch on this is some of the commentary, especially coming out of the federal government and the Justice Department, is that our penitentiaries are full of nonviolent drug offenders, and that's simply not true. You know, and I know, and these officers know, that first-time offenders rarely, if ever, go to jail. And for the marijuana laws that I just mentioned, the sentences of up to 2 years or up to 4 years, it's not likely they would ever go to the penitentiary. If they actually serve time, they would probably serve that in the local jail. And the reason I bring this up is because the Attorney General of the United States has said that our criminal justice system is broken and that our prisons are full of people who are nonviolent offenders. Now, I want to start by saying the Justice Department for the United States prosecutes 5% of the crime committed in this country. State and local prosecutors prosecute 95% of the criminal cases. And the reality is, and I know this is true in the state of Tennessee, that our state prison has violent offenders, sexual offenders, or offenders who have committed repeated offenses. There aren't any drug dealers that are standing out here on the street corner selling an ounce of marijuana that are in the penitentiary unless they've done it over and over and over. And that's just the facts. Our Attorney General, Mr. Holder, has directed that the U.S. attorneys decline to prosecute low-level drug offenses. The fact of the matter is, They've never prosecuted low-level drug offenses. For them to take a marijuana case, I dare say it would have to be in excess of 100 pounds. It might have to involve firearms, or it involves a repeat drug offender. So all Mr. Holder has done is directed the U.S. attorneys not to prosecute cases that they're not prosecuting anyway. You know that state and local prosecutors, in particular in drug cases involving first-time offenders, we look for every alternative to incarceration. Diversion programs, drug counseling, probation, the drug courts that we have virtually throughout the state of Tennessee now. So I just want to correct the misconception and the misinformation that's been put out there, and also tell everybody, let's watch and see what happens in Colorado. It remains to be seen whether in Colorado the instance of people in jail for marijuana will go down. You're still going to have to enforce that law if people under 21 have marijuana, for instance. That's against the law. If you're from out of state, you can't go to Colorado, buy it, and take it out of the state. That's a violation of the law. It's going to be heavily regulated as to how much you can buy. You cannot use it in public, for instance. You can't go in the restaurant or a bar and light up a joint. So there's a lot of misconceptions about what is and what isn't legal. And here again, I'll touch on this. The Justice Department has said they won't prosecute any marijuana cases in Colorado, even though marijuana is illegal in our federal system. So here again, our Attorney General is deciding what cases to pursue and what cases not to pursue. So I just bring this to everybody's attention, hopefully to keep you aware of it, and ask everybody to look at it, and let's see what happens in Colorado and see if other states follow that lead.
Along those lines, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. First of all, as far as the state of Tennessee passing a law legalizing marijuana, have you heard of any movement in that direction?
No, I have not. I'm sure there are people that favor the legalization of marijuana in Tennessee, but I have not heard of any serious talk of any legislation being introduced.
And now a question that's probably unfair to ask of you, but would you anticipate that at some point we may have a situation where the federal government steps in and possibly has a law to legalize marijuana or tries to pass one?
Well, I don't see that happening, and I'll tell you why. I think that would go against what they've done here by deferring to the sovereignty of the state of Colorado and also to Washington, saying we won't step in and enforce the laws there. So that indicates to me that they're going to leave it up to the individual states, and in my opinion, that's the way it should be. The federal government tried that with alcohol in 1933. Didn't work too well, so I don't anticipate they'll try that experiment again.
Thank you, Bill.
United Grocery Outlet is your one stop for savings. Here's Eric Habel, manager of United Grocery Outlet.
We offer some great everyday values. That's kind of our unique position in the grocery business. We're an outlet grocery store, and what that means is we may not carry everything that you need, but you have to come in, because what we do have is a true value to the customer every day.
All right, let's say our church is having a big cookout at the end of the week. You need hot dogs, need hamburgers, need all that stuff. Can you get it really cheap there at United Grocery?
Yes, sir, Scott. We believe that we've got the most competitive prices in town, and that's one thing that we can offer to everybody every day. And we have a full-line produce department, a full line of fresh meats, and then we have some just tremendous everyday values that are in our grocery, our frozen, and our dairy department.
United Grocery Outlet, at the intersection of South Church and Broad Street.
Every homicide, every rape, every robbery affects the entire community. People who are victims of these crimes need closure. The people who committed these crimes must be held accountable. Law enforcement needs the community's help in seeking justice. Please listen as we review an unsolved mystery in this month's
Cold Case Profile.
It has been over 7 years since two-year-old Annalise Guerrero was reported missing from her Smyrna home. Annalise's disappearance and murder shocked the Smyrna community. According to reports, the toddler's mother discovered that Annalise was missing on the morning of April 24, 2006. She reported that she had last seen her daughter the night before after putting her to bed. Her mother said she woke up in the middle of the night and discovered that her daughter was gone. Annalise was last seen wearing a little jean dress with little sunflowers on it. After receiving the report, law enforcement and community members conducted an extensive search of the Smyrna area, even draining Stewart's Creek looking for two-year-old Annalise Guerrero. Over 60 people were interviewed when Annalise disappeared, but Annalise could not be found. On January 4, 2008, a couple on a nature walk in the Stones River battlefield found skeletal remains. This was just a few dozen yards away from the old Nashville Highway. Then in March of 2008, local newspapers reported that the remains had been identified as being Annalise Guerrero. Additionally, the medical examiner ruled that Annalise had been killed by blunt force trauma. The clothing that her mother had described was found nearby. This led investigators to believe that Annalise had been killed around the same time that she disappeared. The person who killed two-year-old Annalise Guerrero is still at large. It is a cold case that troubles the Smyrna Police Department every single day. The department's investigators are now renewing their efforts to find this little girl's killer. Despite the fact that many of the people involved initially in the case, including family and witnesses, have moved from the area, investigators remain dedicated and confident that this case can and will be solved. Anyone with information is urged to call the Smyrna Police. There has also been a large reward offered for anyone with information that leads to the arrest. You may have the missing piece of the puzzle that solves this case. With us today are two of the investigators who have worked on the Annalise Guerrero case. We welcome to the program Detectives Jason Anderson and Alan Neighbors of the Smyrna Police Department. Welcome to both of y'all.
Thank you.
It's good to be here.
Alan, can you tell us approximately how many people initially have worked on this case and how many people in the department have been involved in this particular case?
Practically the entire police department has been involved in this case. We've had basically the entire police department. We've had numerous personnel from the FBI, TBI, community members that have come out to volunteer to help look for when this initially happened. We've still got FBI closely involved in the case.
I know then, reading the summary that we discussed, that there was a draining of Stewart's Ferry or Stewart's Creek. Jason, Detective Anderson, can you tell us, and feel free to chip in also, Detective Neighbors, can you tell us about why y'all decided to do that and the efforts used to try to locate her?
Well, during the investigation, the FBI utilized several different cadaver dogs. And for those that don't know, that's a dog that basically looks for the scent of a decaying or deceased body. Several of the dogs indicated that there may be a cadaver in the creek or within the area of the creek, and during the investigation, from what I understand, that's led to the most likely scenario, so they felt like that was the best thing to do to rule that out or find the body.
Detective Neighbors, can you tell us approximately how far, and I know this is an approximate distance, is it from Annalise Guerrero's home, where she disappeared from, to the area where the remains were found, which is Stones River Battlefield?
It's approximately 7-8 miles.
Okay. At this time, are y'all actively pursuing this particular case, and are y'all following up on leads?
We are. We actually received, Detective Anderson and I actually received the case about 6 months ago. One of our detectives that was working on it moved on to bigger and better things. So we took over the case about 6 months ago and have been combing through all the information. There's a lot of information to go through with all the interviews that were conducted and everything else. And once we get through reviewing everything and putting everything together that we need, what we'll do is send the entire case, a copy of the entire case file, to the Fusion Center, get them to put everything in chronological order for us, and basically build a timeline for us at the same time. While they're doing theirs, we'll be doing more reviews, developing leads, suspects that we need to talk to, witnesses, just re-interviewing everybody that we can find, and going through the case.
Detective Anderson, can you tell us if someone has any information concerning the death of this two-year-old toddler, how would they contact police?
Contact 459-6644, and just... Everybody at the police department is familiar with the case, and they'll know who to get the information to. It's been a lot of time that's passed since this, so if you have any information whatsoever, whether you think it's relevant or not, please call us. Time's passed. People have moved, relationships changed, and feelings have changed, so we think there may be somebody out there that may be ready to share some information with us.
We thank both of y'all for being here, and as we end the program, we want to thank all of our guests for appearing today. And appreciate WGNS providing the airtime for the program and their willingness to promote this public service to our listening audience. And most of all, we want to thank all of the listeners and hope you will become a regular listener. This program airs the first Friday of every month from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. on WGNS.